Amital this week. Okay? Very subtle issues, but very important ones. And I'll never forget the first time I heard this Ramban from Rav Amital. Ish po say liot? Say, come on, answer. Are there Israelis here?
No.
Oh, shucks. We attached here.
Maybe we can do some of it.
Okay, it's acceptable, exactly. As Ramban back to Matala Sefer Shemot.
No, I was kidding.
Okay, girls, seriously. Try to read Rambans. It's a nice place to start moving towards. If you want to understand why the Ramban is so important, take a look at that book I recommended called Mevachshei Panecha, The Interviews Between Rav Sabato and Rav Lichtenstein. There's a 10-page section in which Rav Sabato says, well, on my grandfather's table in Cairo, we spoke about the Rambam all day, and Rambam talks about his relationship with the Rambam as a man of synthesis, as a man of pulling together both within Parshanot and as far as Kabbalah and appreciation for the broader world. Very, very interesting personality, the Rambam. I think Rav Lichtenstein once said, if he was stuck on a desert island, he'd take one sefer, it would be the Rambam. One of my famous lines. Let me do the Rosh Hashiva. We're at one of these big, like respectful rabbi panels, and they were all asking each rabbi, what would be the book you'd take to an island? And one answer was holier than the other one. And this one says, I take this book. It couldn't be a Hebrew book. It couldn't be a Sefer. And I think Rabbi Schreiber was Thomas Aquinas, you know, man of all seasons. For one by one, one book was holier than the next. So I was the last person on the panel to say, I could take just one book to an island. It would clearly be How to Build a Raft. That would be my choice. I'm not taking any holy books. I'm taking my ticket off the island. I was there wanted, but I always have to get off the island. So, holy man. So, Rav Aaron tells to read the Ramban. Very often he'd read the Ramban. Rav Amital less so. Rav Amital didn't quote the Ramban a lot. He quoted the Maharal a lot. That Maharal was a transition between the classic world of Kabbalah. Maharal tried to take the world of Kabbalah and to put it into metaphysical terms. So Kabbalah's mystical terms, the Maharal's metaphysical terms. Today the Maharal is not really so accessible to most people. Numbers and how many sides a triangular shape has and what it refers, everything is a symbolism. We live in a much more existentialist world. We're not into symbols. We don't live world through symbols. We live world through more experience and identity. And it's pros and cons to each, but everything in the Maharal symbolism and what everything is a metaphor for, and Rav Amital employed that same skill for metaphor, but in existentialist terms, where the metaphors weren't predetermined by shape, number, size. They were extracted by associating ideas with symbols that you came across. So we'll see some of those today. So Rav Amital quoted very few Rambans. I'll talk about some of the metaphors of Rav Amital in Parsha Shemos. But he did quote this Ramban, and it's a really seminal one, and it reflects so much of what Rav Amital taught us about the state of Israel. And I've said this to you before, we spoke about it during Hanukkah. And it was a very controversial one. The night that Rav Amital first quoted this Ramban to us on a Friday night, there were fistfights in the Kish dining room. Not really fistfights, but it almost came to that. I can still remember the screaming. That's how agitated our Israeli cousins were by the Rav Amital saying something which sounded less than hyper-nationalist or less than hyper-redemptive. So let's read the Ramban, because it's an important Ramban on many fronts, so it's an important Ramban to know. Ramban, the beginning of Shemos, source number one. Ramban says as follows. Hishlim ha-kasev sefer bereishis. Let's read it together, because each line is important. Independent of the thesis and the main thrust, there's a lot of subtlety to this. Hishlim ha-kasev sefer bereishis, shu sefer ha-yitzira. As you know, each sefer in Chamish Chom Shetar is a nickname. So actually, bereishis has two nicknames. One is the obvious, the book of creation. What's the other nickname Chazal gave it? Sefer ha-yisharim, because feel a parallel to creation. You create worlds by integrity and morality. So Avos created their world. While Hashem created the natural world, Avos created the moral world, moral communities, the moral spirit. It's called Sefer Yitzirah, Sefer Yisharim. Bechidosh Ha'olam, about the creation of our world, V'yitzirah, it's called Notzar. V'mekrei Ha'avos, and of course not just Genesis, but all the stories of our Avos, Shehein Ke'inyan Yitzirah Lazarim. So the Ramban is looking for topical integrity. It's not as if there are two parts of Sefer Bereishis. One part of Sefer Bereishis is the genesis of a universal world. The other part is stories of our Avos, historical or maybe moral. No, they're creating historical templates for the future. So they're creating history in the same way. If they're living history or they're launching history, maybe they don't belong in Sefer Bereishis. Maybe they belong. Maybe there should be a sixth Sefer called Sefer Avos. So the Avos are creators, not just human beings. Maaseh Merkavah, they're quasi Maitre Merkava for the Ramban. If you're interested, this is a great, if anyone's looking for a term project at the end of the year, a personal project, to trace the Ramban's statements in Sefer Bereishis about Maisa Avos Siman Labanim. That's not exactly the way it's phrased by Chazal, so that itself is part of the challenge, looking at how Chazal articulated in the various Midrashim. But the Ramban is probably the biggest amplifier of this issue. Rashi speaks about it here or there, but for the Ramban, every time you turn around, there's an av or an im or an aim taking some action that's prescient or formative for subsequent historical templates. You just have to follow. The people have written articles on this, but it's interesting to see how the Ramban expanded that concept. So it worms its way into the introduction to Sefer Bereishis. They are, line number 2, Shem Ke'en Yetzirah Lazaram, B'nei Shekol Mikrahim, Tzirei Devarim, Lirmoz Olodia, Kol Atid Lavo Lahem. So that's his quick synopsis of Bereishis in his introduction to Shmos. By the way, each Sefer, by the way, has its own introduction in the Ramban, and they're all, not all of them, most, many of them are very, very crucial. The Acharei Shehishlim HaYetzirah. So now creation is concluded. Hitchol Sefer Acha Be'inyan HaMaisa HaBa Min HaRemiz HaMailo. So true to form, Shmos emanates from those templates. Remazim is a template. So this isn't new. This is the continuation. Now the templates are being sent into action. Now we're actually minting reality. Then it's Yached Sefer Ve'ela Shmos Be'inyan HaGolos HaRishon HaNigzar Be'perish HuVe'gula Mimenu. So this is the first exile, the first redemption. V'lachein, okay, here's where the Ramban comments on the very strange introduction to Sefer Bereishis. Elish Mos Menezel Abim Sayavash, Yaakov Anup Ishuv Esel Bo, Ruvain Shimon Velevi, you have the names already, the first Rashi. By the way, interesting to compare and contrast the first Rashi in Shmos to the first Rashi in Bereishis, because they're both editorials that aren't necessary to the narrative of the Pesukim. So Rashi clearly, consciously begins the narrative or his commentary to Sefer Bereishis with his historical thesis that Hashem introduces Sefer Bereishis to tell us to tell us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world so that if there ever would be a situation that people would be contentious about the Jewish right to Israel, not that it would ever happen, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was front-loading ownership and proprietary nature. Here it's a little bit different. Here, because you're going to read about slaves who are downtrodden or persecuted or are discriminated against, so Nimshul L'Kochavim, very famous Rashi, El Shemos Bnei Yisrael, Monim Mispar L'Kochavim L'Cholam Shem Yizikra, quotes the Pasuk, actually it's a slightly different Pasuk in Yishai, but it's the same gist, that we're like stars, Hashem gives each of us a name, that as much as we're downtrodden, this is a Rashi of Avas Yisrael. If the first Rashi in Sefer Bereishis is a Rashi about Eretz Yisrael, the first Rashi in Shemot is a Sefer about Avas Yisrael. How crucially important every Jew is, even though you're going to see them murdered and discriminated against and raped and whatever, there's still a Kedusha that Moshe comes to reclaim. Okay, now, Misparam, so therefore their names are repeated. Afal Pishik Far Nichtav Zeh, so for the Ramban it's less metaphoric, but that's why it's repeated. Bavur, here's another thesis, Ki Iridasam Sham, Horesha Takalot, Ki Miasuchal. When they descended, so we have to, this is setting the table for Galut. Keep in mind, this is going to be a very important innuendo. He hasn't said anything much yet, but this innuendo, Jews descending in Mitzrayim, is the first stage of Galut. Vihine, Hagalut Enenu Nishlam, Ad Yom Shuvam El Mekomam. Here's an important phrase. Try to remember this phrase. Ve'el malat avotam yeshuva. Very poetic. Malat avotam yeshuva. That phrase is going to return. Ve'el malat avotam yeshuva. Okay, so what happens? Ushiyatsum Mitzrayim. So now we've been liberated from Egypt. Oh, it doesn't count. Alpha pishiyatsum beit avadim adayin yechshavu golim. We're still in exile even after liberation, because just because we're physically liberated doesn't mean that Gula has completed its cycle. We're still in a far land. We're wandering through the desert. Okay, stop. So when does Gula complete? Of course, when they get to Eretz Yisrael, right? Wrong. How does Sefer Gula end? They're still in the desert. So here's the key. Here's the score. Gula isn't geographic. Geula is about human beings encountering the Shechina. Historically and nationally, the stage for that is Eretz Yisrael. Again, it's nationally and historically. But the definition of Geula is not national return. It's interaction with the Shechina. And that, of course, concludes Sefer HaGeula, because Shemot ends Parshat Pekudei. V'le'echa Moshe levolo moed kishchana levanan. That's the end of Sefer Shemot. That's what he says. U'chashebo, line number 3 from the end. El Har Sinai. V'yasa ha-mishkan, v'shava kadosh baruch hu, v'yishu shchinato, az shavu el malat avotam. Remember? What does the word ga'ul mean? Where does it come from in the Torah? When the Torah talks about gula, what does it refer to? Ga'alti, but where else? Gula, the word gula. Returning a field to ancestral ownership. So you're returning to malat avotam. You're returning to the interaction with Shechina that the avot enjoyed. That galut interrupts and you're trying to rehabilitate through Gula. If you're a rehabilitating villain, Goelia. Remember in Oval Goel, in Ruth Perek Dalet, the Goel comes to try to redeem and return the land, and it's retrieval. So that's the second time the phrase appears. That's what makes the Ramban so delicious. And by the way, ironically, Rif Sabato as well. You have these people who are just so facile with language. Part of the beauty of Lashon HaKodesh, ironically, since they're speaking English, part of the beauty of Lashon HaKodesh is it's got so many reservoirs and layers of languages. You've got Biblical Hebrew. To a degree, Prophetic Hebrew is a little different than Biblical Hebrew. Even you can see differences in the transformation of language. Then you have Aramaic and Tanaitic, the Babylonian influence. And then you have medieval Hebrew and then modern Hebrew. And you've got a collage of depth and people that can quote all these and or converse in all these. It's just a very, very rich language and the interplay between. The Ramban, you have that. The Ramban knew Tanakh well enough to speak in Tanakh. He'll use phrases. He'll just quote half psukim as part of his. And those of you who've read Rav Sabato, he's someone who in the modern period has taken a lot of those layers and integrated them. It's a real skill. And interestingly enough, does anyone here know the Bednarshes? Mrs. Bednar, she teaches. Rabbi Bednar, she teaches in Wayukala. The Schmidmans from Alon Shavuot. So there's been a revival of Paitanim, people who are able to play around with language and create rhymes and poetry. And in the ancient days, when you got up to Davin, when a man got up to Davin for the Shliach Tzibur, you were expected to make a piur on the spot. You didn't read something from Slichot. It was Slichot, and you were so conversant and so fluent with Tanakh, you would just be quoting psukim from Hosea and from Zechariah and from Yeshaya. We have texts in the Cairo Geniza that show this. Oh, so-and-so, Mr. Al Falgili got up for the Amud today and his piyut, you know, was a little bit dull or something. And Mr. Al Hasimi got up tomorrow, and we see that people were making piyutim and it fell out of favor with the recession of language. And with the regeneration and the revival of language, you've got people today. So I was at a Sheva Bracha Sir Panina two nights ago, and Rabbi Bednarsh benched. It was the bench, but it was predetermined. And instead of saying the classic, which is this little poetic introduction, he made up his own. He made up his own piyut. But that's what these people are doing. At every bris in Alon Shavuot, he or Avi Shmidman teaches piyutim in Bar Ilan University, lives in Alon Shavuot, he'll make up a harachaman for the baby. I'll take the name and I'll say harachaman or yivarech et rach yirda achecha yaducha. I'll just quote a pasuk from Yichi and from Birchat Yirda from Vizota Bracha. So facility with language is part of religious identity, religious experience. So the Ramban is amalatavatam yashuvu, repeats the language. Shayasada loka leah lehem veheim heim amarkava. Key line in the Ramban, heim heim amarkava. Here's where the Ramban calls the Avot Merkava. This is where the Ramban imputes cosmic identity to the Avot. They're not just living prehistoric or prior historical models, but they're actually carrying Hashem's presence in this world the same way the Merkava are. So if anyone stops you on the street and asks you, what does Ramban call the Avot Merkava? Not in his expose on Maisa Avot Simon Abanim in Lech Lecha, but in the Sefer introduction to Sefer Shemot, Heim Heim HaMerkava, V'yaznech Shevu Giulim, V'lechei Nishlam HaSefer Zeh B'Shemon Yan Mishkan, V'yad Kvar Hashem Aleyoto Tamid. So Valentine was basically saying, Gula is not limited to being in Eretz Yisrael. Gula is not geographic. Okay, every single 18-year-old Israeli in 1984 had a heart attack, started screaming, what do you mean? We can live in Chutz La'aretz. We've been trained from birth that you have to live in this country. That's not what Valentine was saying. One of Valentine's basic revolutions, and I've said this in so many different ways, was two things that are related. Number two, opposing this, what he saw as a disproportionate investment in land, as part of the redemptive narrative, and stretching redemptive consciousness, not just to land, but to the type of society we're building. So if you want to take a few steps back, you probably ask your friends, in the Dati Lomi world, there are two sub-strains. One strain is called Kavnikim, and one strain is called Gushnikim. Yeah. Kavnikim, right, have you heard it? You use these phrases?
Tell us all about it.
Your friend, me.
No, in
Megillos. Right. So the Kavnikim are those who are more influenced by Rav Kook's Talmidim and Yeshivos, Haramor and Harbracha and Yeshlan, and to a degree, some of the newly emergent Michlalot, they aren't influenced by those, there aren't that many, because part of it is not necessarily trying to extend Torah learning to women, but the Michlalot certainly were from. And then the Gushnikim are people that are more influenced by, let's say, what this yeshiva and this whole space is created. What are some of those differences? That's not what we're talking about today. But one of those differences is both of these movements, ironically, Gush was more organically linked to settlements because we were a settlement. So that's the irony of history. But settling the land and sovereignty over land is just one among many values in this historical redemptive process, but it's not, at a certain point, Ramitel felt it acquired disproportionate excitement, and it blurred out and obscured other values that may have clashed with it. People were just so... So Ramitel would always tell us he was shocked there in 1948 when there was real talk of giving up Gush Etzion, and people who were living here before, obviously, the massacre. And people who were living here said that they'd rather live here, even under Jordanian rule, than retreat and live in Petah Tikva under Israeli rule. For Ramitel, this was just unacceptable, beyond shock. To be able to abdicate Malchus Israel, to live under Jewish sovereignty and Jewish rule and Jewish self-definition, just because you want to live in a piece of land that you happen to identify as we all do, as our homeland, he thought that was a warping and a distortion of this balance between the two. And another way I've told you about the triangle versus the linear sequence. For Rav Kook's, in Rav Kook's world, many people talk about Eretz Yisrael, Torat Yisrael, Nam Yisrael. It's this triangulation of values that's inseparable. Clearly, everyone agrees to their inseparability, but the triangle suggests equality. And for Ramitel, those three values were a timeline, or they were a linear, reflecting a chronological timeline. And Mitzrayim, when we left Mitzrayim, we became a people. And then Har Sinai, we received the Torah. And at and then we entered Eretz Yisrael 40 years later, and even without the detour after the Meraglim, it would have been subsequent to receiving the Torah, a few months after receiving the Torah, based on the original plan. And for Ramitel, that chronology determines ordination and evaluation. The most important value is Am Yisrael, and Am Yisrael has value independent of whether they're living in their land, and Am Yisrael has value to a degree, here's Rav Amital's Hasidus coming across, independent of whether they're halachically faithful or they adhere to Torah, there's a certain Kedushas Yisrael, independent, and then Torah is delivered, and Torah, as you know, thrives and grew, you know, instead of Eretz Yisrael, there's great richness and depth, and then there's Eretz Yisrael, which is the culmination of Am Yisrael and Torah Yisrael. But if we have to, perhaps, and implicit and sometimes explicit was, because so often, again, 2017 now, it's not like people are lining up to make peace with us, it's not like we've got practical, realistic peace partners. But in the 90s and the 80s, this is a real question. And many questions were articulated then as challenges between Am Yisrael, or I'm sorry, between Eretz Yisrael and Am Yisrael. We want to settle as much land as we can, Eretz Yisrael, but is it healthy for the moral fitness of Am Yisrael, for the demographics of Am Yisrael? Should we be investing in Am Yisrael? Should we be spending money in another settlement? Should we be investing in a development town that's underdeveloped and needs financial assistance? Or for the unity of Am Yisrael? Again, these questions seem very quaint because, unfortunately, geopolitics has morphed to the degree that they're not really practical. But these were very, very contentious issues in the 80s and the early 90s, right around the Oslo Accords. And this was Rav Amital's moment of stabilizing what we all felt was a broader, more complex and composite-based Zionism in Malchus Yisrael, rather than defining it solely through settlements and land. And the irony is, here we are, the largest settlement block, which in large part is a function of Rav Aaron. It also reminds you of something else, which we've talked about in the past, that sometimes you accomplish more without loud announcements and broad proclamation, the flag waving, and just through the slow increment of development and processing. I think a testament to this building we're in and to the growth of Migdal Oz. No one ever started this as part of the feminist movement to try to advance women. It was just a question we needed to extend serious Torah learning to women who are thirsting for it. And we did it without large document, without degrees and getting involved in questions. Just let's educate women in a serious, complex fashion, the same way educating men. And Aaron once said to me, I think maybe even on the interview when he won the Israel Prize 2 years before he was Nifter, I think maybe on the interview he said, who would have ever thought that me, Brisker, Yeshiva University, would win the Israel Prize and be so responsible for populating a place like Gush Etzion. But I think there's a part of him that's really proud to be a Zionist hero. You know, he's the last person on earth, you think. He was a Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Soloveitchik. He was Mr. Lithuania, if there was a Lithuania. He was speaking Yiddish in the Gush Beis Medrash. It's not always a question of how you dress and what flags you wave and what ideology you stamp yourself with. It's just quietly and unassumedly advancing certain needs and letting the ideology and the stigmas catch up with you rather than adopting those stigmas. And I think I keep telling you this because I feel so driven to empower you both, because you really will be at the forefront of our community making these decisions and facing these decisions, and try to discriminate between announcements and hot air and ideologies and Facebook talk and reality, and just creating real models. And sometimes reality has to accommodate certain predetermined social acceptances, sometimes not. But the more that you walk away from some of the bold prognostications, the more space you create for substance and for real experience. And sometimes the ideological contention sucks the air out of the room, and then your real accomplishment, real possibility is precluded. Rav Amital wanted to use this to talk about two different midrashim. Again, it's all just metaphoric. It's nothing. There's a steer in the medrash. If you take a look at medrash number eight, the medrash says, "Habayim mitzayimah v'chayom ba'im." They're coming down to Mitzrayim, present tense. "Habayim mitzayimah v'lo yamim rabim hayu lehem shebarim mitzrayim elo kol zman sheyosef hayakayam lo hayal lehem masui shol mitzrayim." They weren't indebted. They weren't persecuted. They weren't enslaved. "Mate Yosef nitna lehem masui." So the last pasuk in Vayechi is Yosef's patira, Yosef's death. So now really they're coming to Mitzrayim. They've been landed in Mitzrayim many years, but now they're entering the Galus Mitzrayim. Lefikach k'tiv ha'ba'im ki'ilu oto hayom nichnesu le'Mitzrayim. Now this is a steer to a matter that I didn't cite on this page in the beginning of Vayechi, or the middle of Vayechi, that as long as Yaakov was alive, the Jews weren't enslaved. But once Yaakov dies, in the end, not the end of Vayechi, but the intermediate end of Vayechi, then the Galut begins. So, when does it begin? When Yaakov dies and when Yosef dies. So for Rav Amital, this is just a metaphor waiting to happen. There are two Galut. There's the moral, spiritual, communal disintegration. And somehow, as long as Yaakov was still alive, their mentality was of such, and they had enough linkage to that Ma'alat Avotam, as the Ramban said. They were still attached to their previous reality before they were in Mitzrayim. Now that Yaakov died, there was what we'd call a mental, emotional, existential gullet that began, although the enslavement and the persecution was forestalled until Yosef died. So the gullet of our, to use more classic Hasidic terms, of our neshama, of our identity, of our national identity began when Yaakov passes. There's still a stage of Yosef was alive that the Egyptians felt indebted to us, and then finally, Yosef, and then his memory fades, and then at that point, the real physical exile begins. So, these are some of the ideas. I wanted to read just one quote for you. Again, these are all translations of Rav Amital's Hebrew on Shabbos. So take everything in context, but you get the gist. I told you, I was on the team of people that would sit down after Shabbos in the 80s, and we'd sit three or four people together, and we try to recover the three or four shiurim we heard that Shabbos, and these became the VBM shiurim. I get such delight when someone quotes the VBM shiur. Because I was there Matzei Shabbos. I wasn't in the pizza. Okay, call me a nerd. But I wasn't in the pizza shops. There I was, nerdy me with my big 80s glasses, writing down, listening to Hall & Oates, writing down Rav Amital's chidushim. So here it is. Rav Kook speaks in many places. Listen carefully. Rav Amital was a student of Rav Kook, but not in the way that Rav Kook had been taken by the Rav Kook-oriented yeshivos as they started to emerge. Rav Kook speaks in many places of the state of Israel as the foundation of God's throne in the world. Hadar Maglav, Kisei HaKavod. He describes how the existence of this state expresses the beginning of the redemption. Listen to Rav Amital. He taught this many decades before the establishment of the actual state of Israel. So he mentioned this before there was a state. So obviously he's not referring to a political organ. He's referring to historical reality. And divine providence guided things in such a way that when the state was established, it was called Israel. So it became the state of Israel. But when Rav Kook is saying Medinat Yisrael, it doesn't mean Medinat Yisrael. It means a Medinat of Israel, not Medinat Yisrael. In fact, Rav Amital pointed out to us that there was really interesting debate at the formation of the state whether it should be called Medinat Yisrael or Medinat Yehuda. Here, where there was almost called Medinat Yehuda. That would have been interesting historical difference. Okay, would have lived in Judah, not in Israel. Hard to even wrap around your head, living in Judah. Anyway, because of the name, people think that Rav Kook was speaking about our state. But in light of the Ramban's teaching, we may posit that Rav Kook is not speaking about the state in which we live today. Rav Kook's beginning of redemption would take place in a state in which people would not only be living in Israel, but also return to the ways of their fathers, El Malat Avotam, where morality would be elevated. So, can you really apply those cosmic, mystical terminology of Kook to a state which doesn't necessarily adhere to the Malat Avotam? So it works both ways. You can have Geula without having geographic return. You can have geographic return without having Geula. Which is why for Rav Amital, all these phrases were just whenever we ask the Mereshit from Echad Gerula Teinu, you just get caught up in them. Just don't spend your time. What does it mean? And, I mean, to a degree, that's why I'm so allergic to the other one that's on all your minds, Torah Amada. It's just these phrases. And as the generations pass, I mean, such different things. And then it was very, let's get a sidebar, it was very important for Rav Soloveitchik in the post. Let me take a step back, okay? About 9 months ago, I was in Brazil. Okay, now in Brazil, they're so, so far from complex Orthodox thinking. So when I go to Teaneck and I quote Rav Lichtenstein and the Rav, they're right there. When I go to England, I can't even quote Rav Aaron. I haven't read Rav Aaron. A little bit about the Rav, that's my point of reference, but it's all on me. I explain it all from the beginning. When I was in Brazil, basically there are two models. There's one model where you're religious and you learn in Kolo. There's another model where you're Jewish, you're not religious. You eat treif, you eat kosher once. And there's no space in between. The notion that you could be a businessman and keep Torah. I mean, there are a few people, but in the public imagination, and that other model basically is 50% intermarried. It's all, if you're religious, you're a rabbi and you're sitting and learning. Things you take for granted doesn't exist there. Things you take for granted in 2016 didn't exist in 1946 or 1956. There were two models. Either the ever-acclimating American who was quickly abdicating and abandoning the religion of those old fogies in Europe, this new melting pot that didn't care about religion, or the old fogies who were dying out slowly. And there's nothing else. So the Rav had to create a sustainable model. And it's called the Torah Amada. And it was a big chiddush that the people could work and read in foreign culture. Okay, so it means something totally different in 1956 than it did then. To quote articles of the Rav in 1956 is totally historically myopic. Well, you want to sit down in 2017? Should we study Shakespeare? Should we not study Shakespeare? That's an important existential question. But don't obfuscate it and paralyze the whole debate by just superimposing, are we Torah Amada? Are we not Torah? Just get through cliches. We do this so often in Shia where we have a cliche and we show them, what does it mean? What? Just don't give me the cliche. Do this to yourself. It's a great exercise. Don't just follow, what are you saying? What does it mean? Don't give me the term Chefza and Gavra. What are you saying? Give me the actual essence. Because that teaches you to get to the core of reality and identity rather than just getting caught. I mean, I'll be honest, and I hope you girls all realize this by now. If anyone asks me, am I a Dati Lomi Jew? Are you kidding me? I'm embarrassed to be a Dati Lomi Jew. I'm a Jew. I try to be as perfect as I can. I try to love as many people as I can. I decided to live in a Dati Lomi community, well aware of its pros and cons, well aware of the areas I have to compensate for. And if I lived in B'nai Brak, I lived in a Haredi community, well aware of the compromises and opportunities. And why did I choose to live there? In part because I was born into that community, in part because I found it in bullshit, whatever. But I'm not a Dati Lomi Jew. Why should I limit my identity based on some label which is 100 years old and will expire in 120 years? I mean, such depth and richness. So people are stamping themselves with these, I'm this type of Jew, and that type of Jew, and that type of Jew, and it's artificial identity. Have identity and pursue it. Okay, you live in a community. We live in a community. I can't build a school for my children. I can't build a shul for my children. I can't build a mikvah for my wife. We have to pull resources and live in communities. So we pull resources with common people who hold more or less common values. It doesn't mean we choose our identity based on the dictates of what those labels suggest or imply. So that's the first thing I wanted to discuss with you. This first Ramban, you can imagine the scene, the screaming, the shouting. I remember it like yesterday. Dinner table, I just wanted to eat my little cold schnitzel, but people were just screaming and killing each other. And I was partially didn't understand what they were saying, but I knew that history was, some of those people were Yuval Shurlo and Moshe Lichtenstein and screaming and shouting. I just wanted my little schnitzel. Keep asking with some extra rice. I was starving my head off. Boy from Brooklyn, that's all I wanted. Very little food. Okay, that's what I remember about the Shabbos. I was very hungry. Okay. Another metaphor. Here's a clear metaphor of Avamita. Okay? Vayidel hayelet, source 2. Vatevei levas paro. Vahi la leven. Vatekrosh mo moshe. Vatomer. Kimen hamayim mishisiu. Now, as you well know, I'm paraphrasing. I don't think Avamita spoke about this, but Moshe had 10 names. And each and every one of those names is more dramatic than the last. Avigdor, Chaver, Tov, Tuvia, Avi Socho, about the fact that he was her father, and he was a friend, and he was Tov, and Moshe? I mean, I happen to like the name, but Moshe? It's so episodic, it's so anecdotal, it's so irrelevant, and it's endowed by a foreign woman. I think it's the last name that should be adapted. So this is, again, a symbol screaming for some metaphor. It's got to be something more than just Men Amayim Mishisiu. That seems tangential and peripheral. I drew him from the water. It's like saying, oh, I'll call her name. I'll call him back alley because I found the baby in a back alley. So the rest of your life people call garbage can or back alley. Something symbolic, something iconic about this. And Rav Amital quoted the Maharal and adapted the Maharal. Maharal says, and if I, more or less, which is, it's a real revolution of consciousness. When I say material, right, so think about all the material around you. Cell phone, keys, a desk, your clothing, the walls, the chairs, the books, your hair. You think, well, that's durable. That's concrete. That's palpable. I can touch it and feel it. We're talking about spirit. That's something ethereal and abstract and very, very complex. And when the Morale says, in reality, everything of material is transient and ephemeral and passes and fades. And spirit is eternal, and concepts and values, they don't change. So the world of Chomer is in constant flux. It's constantly changing. Though it feels palpable, it's less durable. Whereas the world of spirit, that's the durable, eternal world. So it's a complete inversion of human experience. And within palpable nature, the material that best, again, this is me talking, not really the Maharal, but it's the same spirit. What material best reflects the fact that it's ever in a state of change? And it seems real, but it's always water, because water goes through evaporation, condensation, evaporation. So water is constantly changing. So the water you see, though it seems very powerful, and water shapes our topography, it's in a constant state of change. So the water you see now, it's the quintessential material. Let's call it that way. Moshe being drawn from water represents Moshe being a man of constant spirit and being drawn from a world of material and being able to transcend material and engage in the world of spirit or create a system of values in a religion that is obsessed with spirit. And although it engages with material, it isn't based on material. That's me quoting Rav Amital quoting the Maharal. More or less. It's in the closed door. The door is closed. Now, Rav Amital quoted the Rambam for us, and here, take out this little sheet here, because I quoted the wrong Rambam on the page. I quoted the Rambam in Zayin. This is the Rambam in Vav. Kol HaDvarim Shamarnu, the Rambam describes Nevuah, how a person has to condition himself and his spirit to be a candidate for Nevuah. For the Rambam, Nevuah isn't just arbitrary or whimsical. You have to be a receptacle that's compatible with Nevuah. But even if you convert yourself into that candidate for Nevuah, you can't control. Nevuah is not something that a prophet can elicit. Hashem then has to choose to deliver prophecy through you. So it's necessary but not sufficient. And Bilam is an anomaly. Here the Rambam writes, Kol HaDvarim Perek Zayin Alechavav Kol HaDvarim Shamarnu Heim Derech Nevuah L'chol HaNevim V'Arishon V'Acharonim Chutz Mi Moshe Rabbeinu Rabban Shel Kol HaNevim. Right? The Rambam is describing one of the 13 Ikarei Emuna. One of the 13 Ikarei Emuna is the discrepancy or the difference of Moshe's Nevuah. L'chom Yisuk Moshe HaNevim HaBedes Temunasah. It's in Yigdal, which is a rhyme or a poem of the 13 Ikarei Emuna. Okay, Uma Hefresh Yesh ben Nevuas Moshe Lashar Kol HaNevim, Shekol HaNevim B'Chalom Uvamara, they were dreaming, visitations, Moshe Rabbeinu Mitnabe V'Hu Er, he's awake. Number two, second line, Kol HaNevim Ayde Malach, so they're seeing things in riddles, Moshe Rabbeinu Lo Ayde Malach, but direct. So he's awake and he's direct, without any riddles. Kol HaNevim, line number four, Yireim V'Niv Halim, right? What are the differences practically? The other Nevi'im, when they experience these visitations at night and they can't control it and it's through a malach and it's in rhyme, they're also terrified. They're also overwhelmed. Yireim v'nifhalim mismogegim. They're shaking and trembling. Moshe Rabbeinu kasher yidaber ish esreyeu. Kolam ein adam v'fal is carrying on a conversation with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Kol Nevi'im ein misnabim v'chal ishiyirtzu. Moshe Rabbeinu calls man, three lines in the bottom, sheyachbo tzuruch Hashem lov shaso, he can initiate. L'fikach mitnabe b'chaleit sh'nemar imdu v'yashma u'v'zev tichu akel HaKadosh Baruch Hu ha'lamadata sh'kol ha'nevim, second to last line, sh'nevua mistalakim em chozim l'halam, they go back to their reality. When they were nevua, they were in this trance state that they go back to their ohel, shiva lechem le'olechem. Moshe was always in his ohel, proverbially, he was always a human being experiencing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's nevua. These are the four differences between Moshe and the other nevim. For Amital, this just was another way of saying that Moshe was in a constant state of spiritual preparedness because he hovered above the world of material. The second metaphor which Rav Amital associated with this was the metaphor how Moshe arrives in Mitzrayim. Source number 4, Vayikach Moshe es ishto v'yespanav v'yarkivim al ha-chamor. Okay, so there are two interesting textual elements here, phenomena. Number one is, why are we interested? Why do we need to know Moshe's riding on a donkey? Number two is, ha-chamor, the donkey. So the Medrash says, Rashi quotes the Medrash, I quoted Rashi, it's important to read Rashi. Rashi, source number 5, chamor ha-miyuchad, the chamor. Hu ha-chamor she-chavash Avram la-kedas Yitzchak. This is Avram's chamor from Akedas Yitzchak. Hu she-asid melech ha-mashiach la-hagol egal asala. This is Mashiach's chamor that he'll ride on. Ani v'rochev el-chamor b'asad in-Zachariah. And as the Medrash says, this chamor was created during Bein HaShemashos, during Bria Sa'ola. Okay, you ready, girls? Here's what it means to be a metaphor. There isn't an old donkey that outlives history with a long white beard and a walking stick that Avram rode to the Akedah and Moshe arrived in Mitzrayim in Melech HaMashiach. Well, it's a metaphor. And what's a donkey a metaphor for? Well, play with the words. Chamor is Chomer. So Moshe, Avram, and Mashiach riding upon Chomer means dominating the world of material with the world of spirit and ideas. Riding on a donkey is people, like, you have different donkeys. That could be the same actual, Shrek? Is that the one with a donkey? Talking donkey? Not the same, Shrek, right? Not the same talking donkey from Shrek. It's going to be a different donkey, but it's this, and that's why it's created during Bein HaShemashos. Either the donkey or the template of a donkey that will play that role. And then Hashem reestablishes that template each time because it's part of these supernatural turns in history where the world of spirit emerges and dominates the world of material. And for Avraham Avinu, this was a time to talk about how important it is to be involved in spirit and in engaged. I'll take a few steps back from Avraham Avinu's voice, I'll go back to it later. It's hard. I don't know you well enough and I don't work with you on a day-to-day basis, but I'd like to think that the same DNA we have over there, we have here. Because we're all trained similarly, and all your rabbis, more or less, we all went through as if they were Ryan, Yeshiva, and Nestor. We all had the same formative experiences. But I'd like to think part of what makes this unique is we're not trying to carve out one model of success, as if this is what it takes to be a successful McDonald's product, this is what it takes to be a successful. I know Yeshiva can, because maybe people are different, but I think it's a little bit more indigenous here. So then the question becomes, well, what are the benchmarks at a universal? What does it take? What do we mean? For boys, I have it pretty ironed out. I tell them in no uncertain terms, these are the 5 things I expect you to do when you leave Yeshiva, whether you're the next Rav Aaron Lichtenstein or just the next guy going to Columbia, a minion. So those different benchmarks for boys and different benchmarks for girls. But one of the things is not just an objective benchmark. One of them is 20 years from now, I'll stop you on the street and I'll say, what ideal are you living for beyond yourself? So that's my phraseology. For me, I've turned it from spirit into idealism. They're not really the same. They're not really identical. But I'll use my phraseology, then I'll get back to Rav Amital's discussion. I would like to hope that you see your lives as delivered and oriented and designated for something larger than yourself and your own convenience. Now, for many of you, that could just be, I don't want you to think that has to be highfalutin and earth-shattering. It could just be, I'm really interested in raising this incredible, incredible family of B'nai and B'not Torah, and that's how I see it. Maybe I didn't come from such a great family, and that's my revolution. I'm going to be, and for some, it's others. It doesn't have to be attention-grabbing and headlines-grabbing, but it should mean you don't put your head on the pillow at night until you feel you've served something larger than yourself, and you try to deprioritize your needs to those values. I'm serving my people. I'm serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm serving, and this is the way. It could just be doing what you do, but doing it with a whole different consciousness. It doesn't have to be becoming the next president or prime minister. Or it could just be living the life you've chosen, but living it with passion, living it with vision, living a little bit towards that. We're people of spirit. And to just get caught in this world of material and money and just to be able to see that there are, and to see them as more eternal, because material comes and goes. And the irony is people are more migrated or more tethered to the world of material because it's more physically compelling, but it's just illusory and it's just transient. Rav Amital talked a lot about communism. We were living through the Cold War and we were watching the slow crumbling of communism. I've told you the story before. One of my favorite Cold War memories was fasting for this unknown prisoner in a Moscow jail, or Moscow Siberia jail, we heard about, but we didn't know his name, and he was a refusenik, and we all fasted together with the yeshuv, and I remember we gathered in the little square of Alonchot, right near the Makolet. It was such a small yeshuv then, and everyone knew everyone else, and we just gathered in the square, having fasted a real fast, all 9 yards, Kriyas HaTorah and Slichos and fasting. It wasn't just a couple hours, and we called him in his jail cell. Again, I don't know how that call went through. We didn't have a cell phone. They patched him through to the prison secretary or something. Oh, you're a refusenik. Stop the torture. Here's a phone call. Okay, hold on. Take the cathodes off of his legs. Okay, take the nails out of his eyebrows. Okay, you have a phone call. Hello? We're fasting for you. We hope to see you one day in Israel. Yes, I hope to be there one day, in his broken Russian. A week later, Yuli Edelstein comes walking into Gush. He was the guy we fasted for. And he sat down in the Gush. And I'll never forget, some crazy guy, there were a lot of crazies in the 80s in Gush, some crazy guy told Rav Aaron, how could you accept him to yeshiva? He doesn't have such good skills or something. He every holiday. Oh boy, I've rarely seen Rav Aaron angry. I got him angry once, but other than that, I've rarely seen him angry. Don't ask me to tell you what I got. Rarely seen Rav Aaron angry, but this one, he was roaring. We had a prisoner of Zion who just got released from a jail cell. This is before we became Speaker of the Knesset. This is a little stinky Yuli who got out of jail and came to sit with us. But Rav Aaron was just ballistic, irate. How could you dare deny this person a place in yeshiva? It's also a lesson to us about our connection to Jewish history. So Rav Amital, and I remember in 1991, a year or two after the wall fell and communism, this is all history to you, we lived through it, and Rav Amital talking about the emergence and the rehabilitation of Malchut Hashem because communism was founded on agnostic values, and when it was so dominant, it was a recession of Hashem's presence in this world. But on Sefer Shmos, on Parsha Shmos, he would talk to us about a ideology, listen carefully, Marxism, communism, founded upon material and distribution of material rather than spirit and ideology. And the entire ideology of communism is how to distribute material evenly, capitalism. And he thought that that couldn't sustain, that wasn't sustainable. There has to be, sadly enough, Islamic terror is founded on spirit, so it's sustainable. You can even develop an ideology on evil and criminal spirit, but there has to be spirit to it. If there's not spirit to it, it's just going to be materialistic, and it's just going to come and go. It's just going to evaporate. And those types of sichot clued us into spirit. Those types of sichot clue. It's such an important word because it's not palpable, and some people just don't get there. Some people live so much of their lives grounded or anchored to this world of material. And the sooner that you liberate yourself, not fleeing the world of material, but not living for it, your life changes. And you just have a life that's driven by spirit, values, ideas. And then, of course, you decide how much you're engaged in the world of material, but that's not your focal point. And Sefer Shmos, Parsha Shmos, was this moment to teach us that because of this metaphor of Moshe being lifted from the water, the metaphor of Moshe riding on a donkey, or the metaphor of Avraham telling Eliezer, so to speak, or Yishmael, going to Chazal Shnei Narav Ito, in Parshas Vayera, he tells them, Shvu lechem po imachamor. Right? Why is it important for us to know that Avram tells these two Ne'arim that accompany him to Har Moriah, stay back with the donkey. The donkey isn't the donkey. The donkey is the world of material, and we're now advancing to a mountain of spirit. So we're going to ascend to Har Moriah, and you're going to stay here in the world of material, Shvu lechem po not imachamor, but imachomer. And based on the Medrash says that Avram looks at Har Moriah and sees a cloud hanging over the mountain, and he looks at Shnei Narav, or the two just assistants, or again, Yishmael and Eliezer going to Chazal. Yishmael's already been sent away. I said this joke because Yishmael is sent away textually, but Chazal bring it back on stage. Before you go, we need you for the Akedah. We need you to be Mr. Akedah, man. Whoever those two people were, he says, do you see what I see? And they say, I don't see the clouds. Evidently, you're not attuned to the world of spirit. You're not attuned to the world. You're too grounded in optics. You don't have vision, so you just stay here with the world of optics, and I'll go to vision. And there's this beautiful interview with Rav Amital. These old, real films, R-E-E-L, like they're taken in a blizzard. It's like this, why do they all have to shoot in blizzards? And Rav Amital saying they were being interviewed in 1969 by the Israeli news agency, Ken Natoem Mashani Oeh, And he says, well, and he's looking out at the mountains. He says, anyway, I can't pin me up. Anyway, I can't use it up. Anyway, I can't. And you're looking at these dead mountains that are, in 1960, they're not growing anything. I always think about that when I'm walking through the Gush and I'm seeing these terraces and I'm seeing a lunch foot and I'm seeing these, listening to Rav Amital and listening to Moshe and listening to Chamor and Chomer and just seeing it, living it, and being able to see things that don't exist. It's called spirit. So now I always get this question because there's such staunch stereotypes about the Shiva. Is it true that Grisha is no emotion and there's no... So I have to answer that question one more time, I think I'm going to kill myself. Just end it all here. Another question. I always loved about Ravar and his patience. He was such a patient man. And you know when his patience was most on display? He would always have these press conferences. And very often the press conferences would be carpetbagged by people from other yeshivas that all come to join for the press conferences. And the first question of every press conference, I mean, 5, 6, 7 times a year over 30 years. Rebbe, to what extent can our Torah be enhanced by studying secular study? You know how many times a poor man had to answer that question? I just put out a recording, give him a link or something. He just went through it again and again. And always started with such hubris. To what extent, because I wanted to sound cool, to what extent can you... So I would always sit there and say, oh my goodness, Rebbe, just don't look at him. Don't incinerate him. Just have some patience. And I always had the patience. So to what, and I try to answer this question. I said, look, I'll tell you about the emotionalism at Grisha in a second in the singing and dancing. But you're probably confusing two words. You're probably confusing the word emotionalism with the word spiritualism. Spiritualism means when it's beyond cognitive. Studying a math equation, for most people, it's not a spiritual experience. For some people, it is, and connected to the real self. For some people, it's a math equation, it's cognitive exercises. But what happens when you feel like there's something happening to you at a very deep level, and you can't trace it to a particular word or sentence? You feel like you're going through an experience. You may not be emoting, you may not be singing. There's spirit in the room. There's spirit in the night. There's something that you're feeling. I'd like to think that there's very, very deep spirit and spirituality at Gush on many levels. And I'll talk about the history and the legacy and the learning and this, that, and the other thing. Now I'll answer your question about when we express that spiritualism emotionally. When do we choose to sing and dance, and how do we? And for a lot of people, there's this, especially in our world of emotion, there's this conflation, and you cheat yourself. Because you don't allow yourself to feel spiritual unless it's emotional, but there are times you should be feeling spiritual when it's not emotional, and it's just deeply spiritual. And your dosage of emotionalism shouldn't be the container that determines your experience of spirituality. In theory, your spirituality dosage is going to be a lot larger than your emotionalism dosage, because there are times you're not going to express it, you're not going to sing or dance. I'm not opposed to singing or dancing, but there's a way to feel and express spirituality. And this is something that he really drained into us or rammed into us. Again, it wasn't doctrinaire, it wasn't forcing, but just the vision. And there's electric sichot. There's a really moments I'll never forget, just the electricity in the room, and especially towards the end of his life when it's very hard to hear him because obviously it wasn't reverberating. People would inch closer. You'd have like this condensing of people around him just to hear this man speak. The third issue I wanted to see about very briefly is the stars and the names. I didn't speak about this that extensively, but I just want to draw your attention. There's a lot of chassidus on this, so if you want Jason Sloss emphasis a little bit, I gave a little share this morning in Yeshiva to the boys after davening, so it's posted already. You can listen to that if you want about why we're compared to stars at this stage. Obviously, stars are a metaphor. This is the great success because we're so numerous. I think there are no makaras that I chose surrounding this, but Rav Amital, this speaks a little bit to what I mentioned before, would speak a lot about what makes, or why, Ve'ela Shemot B'nei Yisrael, Ruvain Shimon Leviv Yudah, Dam Naphtali Gad V'Asher, so names are featured, names, Ela Shemot, and then Rashi pulls in the stars. Why does Hashem count us, V'chazer Emanu? Because Hashem loves us, just like He counts the stars, He counts us. A lot of ways to take this association. But for Ramital, two associated words pop out. Stars and names. Names and stars. Names at the literal level, Shemot B'nai Yisrael. Rashi drags in the stars. And the stars and the names are connected. Mona Mispar LaKochavim L'Cholam Shem HaTikra. What about stars was important for Ramital? And I'll read you just a part of the Sikha. Individuality. Personalization. he didn't say this, but it's pretty obvious when we're compared to grains of sand or particles of earth. Particles of earth, grains of sand, are non-differentiated, and they're clustered together through, you know, there's no value to one grain or one kernel or one, whereas stars are different, and stars, many of them can form the center of a solar system. They're different, they have importance on their own, and as different. In theory, if two stars would be too proximate to one another, they'd explode under their own gravity or own heat. So it's this differentiation to be do things that are different and to accept and Rav Allenthal really wanted us to. I remember this just popped into my mind. Remember in 1994, so I was appointed the head of the program, still exists, of the SACS leadership program. Especially, I didn't have a job. They wanted me to have a job, so they made a leadership program. It was for post-college kids. Really, never. You can still see it. Anyone ever seen the Alayatzion English language? Okay, some couple of post-college kids came back, and we put out a journal. And I remember Rav Aaron would sit there with me and go over each line and the words that we're using. I felt the patience for that. I remember as I was just walking out of his office, just getting a little input. He would say, just make sure that it's creative. Make sure that whatever they're writing is creative. Then this one line is, close the door. And for him, the stars and the names reminded us that we should aspire to be different, obviously within Shemir Star and Mitzvahs, but aspire not to take the shell or the shape of people around us. And to, something I said before about trying to create and carve out multiple and different tracks for your success as future B'nai Torah, future people. Again, dangerous. It's not a hippie convention. It's not how everything goes. How do you create education towards conforming baselines but still open up horizons towards differentiation? That's really the secret of education. What are the values that we all campfire around, that we all agree to? It's the campfire effect. We're all sitting on the campfire we all have to agree to. And then how do you make sure the campfire doesn't devour you? How do you become your own people, and especially within the context of education, where so much of education is moral authority and moral submission, especially religious education, we're telling you, these are the values more or less we hope you submit to, and that we're the authorities to transmit those values. How do we do it without crushing personal initiative? And you can begin to see some of your friends who are in yeshivas, which or programs and seminaries, which shade more towards submission and less towards personal creativity. And it's easier to be successful that way, but the upper levels of success are harder because you're robbing personal identity initiative as the price for creating submission and belonging. So that's really is our way out. You have to find some balance between the two. So I just wanted to read to you what Rav Amital said. Okay. Okay. Rashi and the Medrash mentioned two concepts, number and names. Number, I'm sorry, I lost the subtlety. Number refers to commonness, similitude. He didn't use that word. Okay, names refers to special quality of each individual. So actually, sense the contrast. The numbers, when you number something together, the numbers and names. He didn't talk about stars, numbers and names. Am Yisrael compared to stars. Each star is a world in itself. Each one is different from the others. Each person has qualities unique in him. Each has his own name. No one believes this, but does this become the centerpiece of your sicha? And when we disagree with this, but to give a sicha about this. That's what made it so dominant. Today, there is a tendency towards mass production, and little value is attached to individual craftsmanship. Companies produce thousands of items each day, all completely identical to each other. The tendency in society, too, is to be fashionably in, to be like everyone else. In yeshiva, each person wants to learn like everyone else. One of the Gedolim once said that Rabbi Saul Salanter was remarkable in that his Talmidim all turned out different from one another. All were great, but each in his own way. Rabbi Saul Salanter, three Talmidim. Does anyone know any of them? The three big Talmidim, Rabbi Saul Salanter, who then took Musar to the masses, were three people. Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer, Rabbi Allenthal was very close with. He's called Rabbi Yitzchak Petersburg because he was a Rav in Petersburg, St. Petersburg for many years. Rabbi Naftali Amsterdam. And the third one was Rabbi Simcha Zissel Broidy, or Simcha Zissel Ziv. He was the Rebbe of the Altar of Slobodka, so he was the godfather of the Slobodka Yeshiva. But he's a very interesting figure in his own right. If any of you want to do a little bit of research into the evolution of the Muslim movement, this is a fascinating movement in the early to mid-19th century, there's a classic canonical five-volume Hebrew work written by someone named Katz. I forget the first name, but it's the Katz five-volume Tanuata Musar. Really, really well done. And he has 40 pages on this one, 40 pages on that one, his biography. The Hebrew is not, for you girls, it shouldn't be too prohibitive. It's really accessible, but it's really, really fascinating to see how it evolves. Yisrael Salanka, as he created this movie. In the past, one could talk about the different tzaddikim, customs. Today, there's almost no such thing as a certain tzaddik having an individual custom, because as soon as the tzaddik behaves in a certain way, everyone else immediately imitates it. The person must find what is unique about himself and not just imitate others. Obviously, in the early stages of one's development, one has to take one and assimilate the common foundations and standards. But thereafter, each person should develop along his own individual path. So he's talking about the contrast between numbers, conformity, monotonic, and names, in which each person is different. He didn't talk about sand and stars specifically, but that's really the composite of it. So these were three sichot we had during Shemot. One, the first Ramban introduction to Shemot, redistilling Geula in a way that isn't solely geographic, in a way that made our experience, I think, more resilient. Because if so much of your Zionistic imagination is poured into land, what happens when land is surrendered? And that's some of the second era, that's some of the tensions and stressors you felt. Ramitel never made it all about land, so when land was compromised, Zionism wasn't affected. We still saw a larger script. And I think, I'd like to think, we're vindicated. I'd like to think that at all levels, we have seen our people and thereby redemption flower over the last 20 years, even though our land hasn't increased, but it's decreased. I mean, we like to think the state of Israel is a much better place than it was in 1996 in all fronts, in all sectors. And we like to think that the improvement of the state of Israel is a process that's driven by divine hand that's reflective of a divine intervention. So I'd like to think that Geula doesn't have to be tethered solely to land acquisition and extending sovereignty. Well, that's supremely important to us. Yes, Noah?
But what makes Geula from an individual thing to a thing that's for the nation, if not for the land?
Well, history, state, sovereignty. In theory, let's say, even if we were to return to Uganda and establish a Jewish state, in theory, the fact that we're governing ourselves and so on and so forth, that would be an element. It's a composite. It's not all or nothing, some game, but there would be an element of it. Certainly the flowering of Torah, in our, what I see as a direct outgrowth of Kol Miyot, and there's only so many areas, the state of the Jewish people, the state of Jewish pride, and I think there's so many areas that I feel reflect Hashem's malchus, not just whether we do or don't control Gaza. The second issue he spoke about was this water icon metaphor of material, Moshe being drawn from water, Moshe riding on this donkey that Avram rides upon, that Mashiach will ride upon. Third aspect was the contrast, again, between names and numbers. Numbers suggest conformity, names suggest individuality, and he would always point to societal trends. You know, he really felt as if you couldn't separate societal influences from Torah. Clearly, people were responding religiously the way they were living socially, economically, politically. So he'd always say, well, what are the dangers facing a Ben Torah? Not just during Averus, but what types of mental or mentalities or modalities would be adopted from the modern world. He was one of the mass production, creating a tilt towards uniformity and conformity rather than individuality. Okay? Shakoch, everyone, yes?
Okay. I feel like we have to ask you, what ideal are you living for beyond yourself?
Oh, very easy. God, people, and country. God, family, and country.